You're listening to Trending with Timmery, offering an eternal perspective on today's hottest topics. National speaker Timmery Millington has been a passionate advocate for life as long as she can remember, helping Gen X through Z answer the call to true feminism and authentic manhood. Timmery holds a master's degree in biblical theology, and she covers this week's hottest stories from a Catholic worldview. You're listening to Trending with Timmery.
Good to be back with all of you, Timmery here. It is a great gift to have with me today in studio, well, actually our satellite studio, you could say, for the day here at the Notre Dame campus. We're at the De Nicola Center for Ethics and Culture. And I have with me today Richard Dorflinger, and he has served for more than 34 years as the Associate Director of the Secretariat for Pro-Life Activities of the United States Catholic Conference of Bishops. His professional background is really diving deep into testifying before Congress, National Bioethics Advisory Commission, the National Institute for Health, in various states on bioethics issues. I could go on, but his background has really been in implementing public policy, from writing it himself to actually advocating on its behalf and bringing truly a Catholic principle into the public sphere. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
So, especially in the state of California where I live, but it's becoming a trend across the nation, is physician-assisted suicide. Mm-hmm. Now, in California, I can be sitting at a coffee shop, and I am guilty as charged of being an eavesdropper. And I'll hear conversations probably once every 2 weeks, actually, of people talking about physician-assisted suicide. Well, you know, if my mom is sick, I would really just, you know, prefer that she didn't suffer. Whether it's maybe they themselves saying, I'd rather not be a burden on my family. Culturally, this is becoming very quickly ingrained in our culture. And so I'd like to talk to you about this today. Initial thoughts on physician-assisted suicide.
Well, I think the first thing to recognize about physician-assisted suicide is that it's about suicide. And suicide is a terrible tragedy in any family. And it's a public health crisis in the United States. We've had a rising suicide rate. And I believe that the idea of justifying it for people who are seriously ill has led to greater acceptance of it and greater temptation to it in other populations as well, including the young. That's one of many negative consequences people are not talking enough about. Mm-hmm. We know that most suicidal feelings are due to depression or other mental disturbance. That's as true of people who are tempted to it when they're sick as it is among other people. And the agenda is really being driven by fear, fear of painful, lingering death. You say fear of being a burden on others. But we all should be a burden on others when we need it. That's our whole message as Christians, for one thing, is to say that we are all one family. We need solidarity with each other. We need to help take care of each other. I certainly want to have family and loved ones willing to take care of me when I'm dependent for help. And I expect to be called upon for that by others. So there's this model of isolated autonomy that is something of a myth, because we all need each other all the time, that is driving this, saying, well, I see no meaning in continuing to be with my loved ones and continuing to receive care. I just want to opt out. But it's something that certainly our moral teaching in the Catholic Church and most churches is seriously wrong. And it's also giving into a despair that there are solutions for.
Mm. Living in a post-Christian era, though, the principle surrounding the idea of not caring for a loved one has more so become predominant. You know, you have people sending their parents today this kind of letter of no contact. I don't know if you've heard the trend of going no contact, where adult children, predominantly millennials, are actually writing this letter of goodbye, thanks, however, I'm asking for no contact from here on out because you're weighing on my psychological mindset, my pursuit moving forward. And a lot of these letters are actually kind of cookie cutter, the same letter just being repeated over and over again. And It's scary for, I think, as we see the boomer generation beginning to age out, where they do not have people willing to take care of them. And so for some, they think, I'd rather not be alone as well, which becomes a really difficult issue. And so I want to get later on into the issue of suffering, but I want to come back predominantly, why has this taken place? And you were recently speaking at the De Nicolas Center for Culture and Ethics, as we were at the Vita Institute, and you hit on two very fundamental Christian principles. And I want to start with appealing to loving our neighbor as ourself, as you talked about, and St. Augustine really talking about how our self has to come first.
Yeah, St. Augustine was in a situation during the fall of the Roman Empire. There was a great deal of chaos. There were barbarian invasions. Some Christian women were assaulted, were raped during these invasions. And some of them felt they had been shamed, they were disgraced, they were tempted to end their own lives. Of course, in the Roman society, suicide for, ideas of honor and so on were not unpopular. And Augustine said two things about that. And he wrote this in his masterpiece, The City of God, right in the first book. So the first thing, to get people to read my book, first thing I need to do is make sure they don't kill themselves before they can read it, right? is, you didn't do anything wrong. This is not some taint that attaches to you as a person. You were the victim of this. You have nothing to be ashamed of. People who fail to stop it should feel ashamed. Certainly the rapist should be ashamed for the rest of his life. But there's no reason for you to feel disgraced. Secondly, suicide is as much against the commandment, thou shalt not kill, as murder is. We're called to love our neighbor as ourselves. That means we have to love our own lives, too. If you can't murder others, you can't murder yourself. Mm-hmm. I mean, even the German word for suicide is Selbstmörder. It's self-murder. Mm-hmm. And your life is as much worth respecting as anyone else's. You have to love yourself and the gift of God that is you, so that you can then spread that to others. That's been a consistent tradition in the Christian world up to the present day, when we have Pope St. John Paul II, in his great encyclical on the Gospel of Life, saying objectively, suicide is as wrong as murder. And those who would assist somebody else in suicide, who are not depressed, who are not vulnerable, who are looking at this from the outside and saying, oh yes, you're right, your life has no value, and give them the means to kill themselves, are far more guilty, because the depressed person is under the influence of mental disturbance, a kind of tunnel vision, thinking this is some kind of solution and the only solution for them. But a physician or other person who would assist in that is more guilty of helping to cause someone else's death.
You're listening to Trending with Timory. I have in studio with me Richard Dorflinger. And I love how you appeal to how St. Augustine was addressing the issue of suicide. He was addressing essentially the issue of what people today call mercy killing, right? Death with dignity. But you're appealing directly to the issue of rape. And we just saw a huge headline recently was a 17-year-old young girl from the Netherlands who it claimed she took her life via physician-assisted suicide. I think more information has come out over the last couple of weeks. It sounds like it wasn't directly physician-assisted suicide, but other situations involved here. But we're at a time where a 17-year-old is able to justify the ending of her life after she has already had an incredible violation done against her. And you would think that the feminist movement would be advocating for women such as her to receive more resources, counseling, aid, maybe a stronger platform. Yet these are the same people whose lives are being justified as discardable based on our own self-determination and self-autonomy.
Yeah, autonomy is a myth. When someone is traumatized by a past assault and is left alone to say, my only solution is to, in her case, she starved herself to death.
Right.
And people just stood by and watched that. But what are we doing to ourselves when we say, this human life, this person who is injured, who is damaged, who is traumatized, who needs help, who needs suicide prevention, that, she's making a free choice. Well, it wasn't a free choice. It was trauma. It was depression. It was despair. Right. We have no answer to that, because if we don't have an answer to that for those cases, What do we say to people with other reasons for taking their own
Transgenderism,
lives?
Transgenderism, we've seen some examples of this where it's justified.
People have tried to justify it for other instances of failed love affairs, of financial ruin, mm-hmm. of being found out and having done something wrong in terms of the law. All of these are things that can be dealt with, but not if you first kill yourself. And the same is true of serious illness. I mean, there are, even when there's no cure for an illness, there are ways of alleviating pain, of alleviating discomfort, of addressing people's psychological distress and allowing them to be at peace even during the dying process. Not that all the people who are being assisted in their suicides in California and elsewhere are really terminally ill in any meaningful sense of that term. They're seriously ill. Doctor says you'll be dying in 6 months, and then they give them the pills to kill themselves, although they'll never be proved wrong, because long before the 6 months are up, they committed suicide.
Well, and we have the case of a woman by the name of Stephanie Packer in Southern California, and she, as soon as some of the implementation of the current medical system and insurance system was implemented, she right away already had a terminal illness. She had already surpassed her predicted, right, date of no longer living, and she has 4 children, and yet she's gone to live years beyond that, yet all the insurance companies will cover are the pills to end her own life. Yet here's a young mother with years of time with her children. We'll be coming back in just a minute with Richard Dorflinger. Don't go away. You can find more about Richard and his work at radiotrending.com, where you'll find his profile.
Timmery will be right back. Send her a tweet at Timmery. That's T-I-M-M-E-R-I-E. You're listening to Trending with Timmery, where morality and culture meet, offering an eternal perspective on today's hottest topics.
We're back from Notre Dame at the De Nicola Center for Ethics and Culture with Richard Dorflinger, who has been prominent over the last 35 years, recently retired, but not so retired. He is still instrumental in not only having worked to testify before Congress, National Bioethics Advisory Commission, in various states on bioethical issues regarding both the end and beginning of human life. And we're talking about physician-assisted suicide. Just before the last break, I mentioned Stephanie Packer and how she has outlived by a number of years the diagnosis that put an end cap on her life. And she had been offered, for those just joining us who didn't hear it, pills many years ago now by insurance companies as to end her life. And that's all she was offered for further medical care.
And we're seeing that elsewhere as well, in Oregon and in California. Patients or their doctors have been told, no, we will not, you know, by an insurance company, for example, or by the Oregon health system, that, we will not pay for that next treatment that might prolong your life, but we will pay for assisted suicide. And so there's financial pressure as well. Why would you be surprised that people then feel they're a burden by failing to take that up? Nobody's willing to pay for them to get real treatment, but the society is willing to pay for them to take this bottle of 100 barbiturates or whatever it is and end their lives. You have society spreading the message, you are a burden. And people who are vulnerable and dependent on others are very impressionable and internalize that message. That doesn't mean they're exercising their freedom.
Right. There's a real slippery slope here. I mean, physician-assisted suicide as itself is terrible, but where the Netherlands has gone with this is absolutely atrocious. We mentioned the young 17-year-old who was going to take her life via physician-assisted suicide, but as you mentioned, she ended up starving herself to death. But, you know, for example, in the state of California and across the nation, you have, for example, 5150 that's implemented. If a person is suicidal, is attempting suicide, they're put in some sort of psychological evaluation center and held for a number of days. Yet under the current law, we could see this where we're no longer doing psychological evaluation, but justification at any age to kill oneself.
Yeah, for the patients who say, I want this, you know, whatever you want to call it, aid in dying, but it's physician-assisted suicide. The doctor who's prescribing the pills gets to decide whether the patient gets any psychological evaluation. In Oregon, 98% of the time, they get no such evaluation.
Wow.
And that's just for the prescription.
Mm-hmm.
And then when the patient or somebody else in the family decides it's time to take the pills, there's no evaluation whatsoever. 100% of those patients are beyond the scrutiny of the law. The doctor is usually not present. The only person who's present is friend or family member or someone who stands to inherit from the person's death who's holding the pills.
And get into this, because this is very, very risky, considering that it might not be the patient that administers the drugs.
Well, and that's being justified, too. The Oregon Attorney General's office said, if somebody's too weak to feed himself the pills and somebody helps, well, you have to allow that because physically disabled people have the same right to this as everyone else, and otherwise you'd be violating the Americans with Disabilities Act.
Mm-hmm.
In Washington State, the next state to pass a law, they said the drugs do have to be self-administered, and then they defined self-administered to mean it's the patient that needs to do the swallowing. So anybody can get those drugs into you. Another way in which this is sliding forward is that the definition of terminal illness now, and this was only recently made clear in Oregon by someone who just asked the health division, how do you interpret this law, about 6 months. It applies to anybody who would die in 6 months if they don't get treatment. And so people are getting physician-assisted suicide because they have diabetes,
mm-hmm.
because they have heart disease that could be managed by medications, because they had benign tumors that are not in any immediate sense killing them. So if somebody refuses treatment and that makes them liable to die in 6 months, then they're terminal, they can get the lethal overdose. Or if an insurance company refuses you treatment, then you're terminal and you get the physician-assisted suicide to finish the job.
You're listening to Trending with Timory. I'm here with Richard Dorflinger. We are on the Notre Dame campus, and we're talking about physician-assisted suicide. This is where I believe the Catholic worldview is so important that we're bringing to the conversation. We don't have to explicitly mention Catholicism in our one-on-one conversations. Unfortunately, today, sometimes that scares people away. But we do have something to say of the benefits of suffering. And as one gentleman presented this week at the Vita Institute at Notre Dame, that there's a difference between helping someone to die in physician-assisted suicide and aiding someone in dying, being present to them, witnessing with them, maybe giving some drugs to assist in alleviating pain, but not a lethal dose to end their life.
Yeah, there's a great deal that modern medicine can do, and it goes beyond medicine. A lot of care for people who are terminally ill now in hospices and so on is keeping company, making sure people do not have to fear dying alone, addressing their psychological upset at what mm-hmm. may face them, addressing there's a kind of existential distress at facing your own mortality
mm-hmm.
that a lot of us spend a lot of time throughout our lives ducking, and now we have to confront those. There's spiritual help for those who are now forced to ask themselves some ultimate questions that they may not have thought about for a while. And the idea is to bring people a sense of peace and to finish unfinished business with families, with loved ones, with people who may have harmed them or who they may have harmed in the past, and then to feel at rest. And that's what people used to call dying well.
Mm-hmm.
That, people would say that's a good death. A good death is in which people have made peace and they are surrounded by love and they feel that they finished the work they needed to do on this earth and are ready for whatever comes next. Good death is not where a doctor gives you drugs and says, please off yourself because we can't think of anything that you're good for either.
I've been very blessed in my lifetime to be surrounded by deaths actually taking place. And I truly call it a blessing because I learned so much, whether it was my great-grandmother, who I got to care for at the end of her life and be present in her last moments, or my uncle who died young. I think about these situations, and these people were able to be present to their family members, at time their own young children or their great-great-grandchildren, and the conversations that took place, the respect for that life and what that life gave to so many others, but also, as you mentioned, you know, making peace with family, but spiritually, you know, receiving the anointing of the sick, going to confession for that last time. We forget that we're a body and a soul. And I think that more familiarity with death, and maybe you're not in a cultural perspective within your family to be surrounded by that. I think where books like St. Alphonsus Liguori's Preparation for Death is very helpful, because it brings death down to the real reality that it's going to happen for all of us.
Yeah, it's and that's, you know, that's not something our culture wants to hear about. You know, we worship youth, we worship physical ability and life of comfort and pleasure. It's not just terminal illness that should make us realize that life is not all about pleasure and comfort. There are hardships in life. Usually they make us better people when we face them and deal with them in a way that allows us to maintain our integrity and our convictions. And that is what builds us up as persons. Somebody who's known nothing but pleasure and comfort is not going to have much of a character. Mm-hmm. And we forget that, you know, with regard to exercise and losing weight and exercising our bodies, we say no pain, no gain. To a certain extent, that's true in life overall. And it's something we forget at our peril.
Oh, and even just the discipline of exercising requires a spiritual component, an act of the will. And it's a reminder we're not just a body going through the exercises of movement, but there's an ascent of the whole body that's meant to coordinate body and soul. And this is the same thing when we come to dying. If you don't have the discipline for exercise, you know, you're not going to exercise physically. But if you don't have that mindset of my life is going to end, and spiritually that matters in addition to my medical care, we're going to lose sight of our purpose as human beings.
Yeah, and it's that purpose is something people don't like to think about even when they are healthy. Mm-hmm. They get hit with it all at once, and that's probably something that really frightens them. Mm-hmm. But there are ways of thinking through that and talking through that. And the solution of treating the patient as just this unproductive object that, you know, as Pope Francis says, becomes a victim of the throwaway society.
Absolutely.
That there's really not, we can't see any value in your life. It really would be a good thing if you went, mm-hmm. Even though we do suicide prevention for everybody else because we do value their lives. There's a country that is committed to the whole idea of equal protection, equal value in everyone's life. We need to be maintaining that at every stage of life.
Absolutely. And we have to remember, you know, the law of gift that we understand from the perspective of our faith, that everything we've been given is an absolute gift. And you spoke to this week, that we are called to be good stewards, not just of our material things, but our lives. Richard, where can people find more about you?
About me?
Well, your work, writings, and so forth.
There's a lot about this issue of physician-assisted suicide and end of life on the website of the U.S. Catholic Bishops Conference. Some of those things I actually wrote when I worked there, and that's usccb.org. And I hope people will look into this more. There's a lot to learn.
Thank you for being with us.
Thank you.
You can listen to more of Trending via the podcast on iTunes or the iHeartRadio app, where you can share your favorite episodes. You're listening to Trending with Timory.
Rick Howick is in studio with me. We had Richard Dorflinger just a little earlier. And I want to touch now on how we need to rediscover what a good death looks like. Now, Rick Howick is the host of Orange County Catholic Radio. He's with us last week here on Trending. He's a new guest. And part of his conversion story from being a Presbyterian seminarian all the way to being a Catholic surrounds one early experience in part of his journey of meeting a young woman in college who ended up discovering in her 20s she had a brain tumor. And Rick, during the last couple years of her life, you were able to witness what I would call a good death, life to its fullness without physician-assisted suicide. Can you tell us a little bit about that story and its impact on you?
Yeah, it's been a while since I've really thought a whole lot about that, which I think we have a tendency to do with things that have emotions tied to them that aren't always entirely positive. And when I say that, it's because when you grieve, they talk about the grieving process. The grieving process really doesn't just come to an end. It continues really in different stages throughout your
life.
So as I'm looking, when I was a few years ago, when I was talking about my conversion experience, I would bring her up just to explain where she was an important part of my experiencing a good Catholic for the first time, where I really got to know a good Catholic for the first time. And part of that was to also see that she really had no real fear of death. Now, I say that because that's too simple. She did have a fear of death, but it wasn't a fear of what happens after death. She had a fear of dying, which I think makes sense. We all have a fear of dying. I really don't look forward to dying either. It sounds painful. But the woman was a good Catholic, and I had never really gotten to know Catholics at that point up close and personal. I had been in high school involved with evangelicals, Protestants who generally looked at Catholicism as not being real Christianity. And this woman that I met in college, I was still evangelical, and she was very Christian. I was therefore surprised to find out that while she had been once or twice or a couple times to an evangelical church, she was Catholic and was a parishioner at a local Orange County parish. I went to Long Beach State at the time, and she lived in Garden Grove, not that far from where we are now, actually. And in fact, she's interred not far from where we are now. And this person, when we would talk about things, because we became very good friends, and it's hard for me to call it anything other than that, but we became very good friends. And part of that was really about talking. I have a tendency, Timory, to bring out emotions in people. So I will make friends with people, and sometimes they'll start dumping. And I'm a pretty good listener. And we would go out, and sometimes all she would do would be to talk. And we would chat and talk and talk and chat. And she talked about her faith, and she talked about what it was to probably be dying because they couldn't remove the brain tumor, and it was growing. And she knew it. She knew that it was likely at some point to kill her. Yet she wanted to experience life, and she wanted to embrace what God had given her in life. It wasn't that she wanted to go out and have thrills. She wanted to embrace what God had given her in life. And that was profound on me, because here we have someone who saw death as a part of living, because as you and I have talked about in a previous encounter, the anthropology of a human being, if you're Catholic, is a body and soul, and it's beyond just this life. And we in the secular world tend to treat it only as this life. So that
only what you accomplish in life, not who you are fundamentally.
Well, and we have a tendency to look at, therefore, the value of a human life is expressed in pleasure and pain. Mm-hmm. And if you are no longer experiencing pleasure in life, well, just end it. Mm-hmm. And what John Paul taught us, both in Script and Miserere Cordia, which is an encyclical that everyone should read, and in his dying from a neurological decomposition of his body while he was still living, was that even to your last and dying breath, you could be having not only an impact on your own life, but on the lives of those around you. And she died at home in a hospital bed, no longer able to recognize most people. She thought I was her brother towards the end there when I would come over. She knew somehow I was a nice guy, but I was not me. But nevertheless, she still was this loving young woman. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until years later that I realized how much of an impact that had on my life. It was as a result of that that I discontinued some things that were happening in my life. I added the major of religious studies. In addition to being in political science, which I wanted to be a lawyer at some point and go into becoming a politician. Oh, thank you, Lord, for sparing us all. But it also made me want to dedicate my life to doing God's will. What do you want from me, God? That's what she did. What do you want from me, God? And that's what it did for me, so that I was able at the end of my my BA, when I couldn't go on to graduate school right away, I chose to go into teaching special ed. And that was a very hands-on, it was, at the time they called them SH, severely handicapped, and there were only six kids, unquote, they were often big, six in my class, two aides, and we had autistics in there who were biters that we had to be very careful with. We had, unfortunately, we had those who were ambulatory and those who were non-ambulatory, and we kind of jokingly would say, predators and prey. It was really kind of sad the way that they had them put in there, almost warehoused. And it reminded me of the love that society has walked away from with these people who are experiencing the love of God. I remember once during that time, I was sitting waiting for the little yellow buses to come, and all of the kids had gone except there was one student who was still waiting. His bus had been delayed. This was the lowest of the kids that were in the school. He wasn't in my class, but I was waiting there. It was my duty to be out there at that time. He was totally vacuous. I mean, he had no ability except he could follow behind somebody. Mm. And yet while we're sitting there, he reached over and took my hand and held it. Mm. And it dawned on me that he may have no intellectual understanding of anything I can say to him, but he gets love. Mm. It's transcendent beyond our intellect.
And he lives one day at a time, which is what also your friend who was dying from the tumor was doing. One day at a time, she was living life and loving. And I noticed how she's looking out to others.
She was. And that was the point. She had wanted to live a life that would be an engagement of God. And if that meant doing ministry work, she would do that. That little boy died the next year, by the way.
Oh, sorry.
But I believe he experienced love because mm-hmm. love is something very different. That was something that, as my friend lay dying, I know that she could still experience. Because even though she may not have recognized me, she recognized the person that walked in as someone who was a loving member of her family,
familial.
Her brother. Mm-hmm. And it was that love that she had that reminded me that our life is not about what we do. Our life is not about what we think or what we even believe necessarily. It's how do we engage the love of God that has come to us? Now, that often comes down to what we do, and it often comes down to what we believe as important parts of that. But in the end, it's a symphony of reality that comes into that. It's what you believe, it's what you do, but it comes from who you are in relationship to God's love. Mm-hmm. And that's what was transforming by seeing her go through her pain and her suffering and her dehydration and her problems all the way up to the end. It was what got people to take a second look at John Paul II as he lay dying with his head crooked over, mm-hmm. sometimes having to be wiped for the drool that was going to come out of his mouth.
As he was in the midst of making public appearances at the same time.
In order to convey the reality that life is not about pleasure, mm-hmm. nor is it about pain. It's about love, and love is an action, not a feeling.
And that's where suffering becomes redemptive.
Yes.
It's not that Catholics are saying you need to suffer to your last breath. It's that Catholics are saying there is value in your suffering, not just for you and offering it up for sins and so forth, but in the witness you show to others, which had a huge impact on why you are Catholic and have spent 25 years in Catholic education teaching young people and now challenging young people in the college atmosphere to have a Catholic worldview.
In 1984, Helen passed away in August, as I recall. And I'm still talking about her today. Mm. Her death still has redemptive value. Mm. And that's something that I think people need to think about. It's not just about you. It's not just about your pleasure or pain. And when people think about, like, physician-assisted suicide, you're cutting short the possibility that you might have one last new understanding of God, or you might bring that to someone else.
That's such a testament to each of our lives. At the end of the day, what is the purpose? The purpose is to be who we are before God. And here your dear friend Helen lived that to her last breath. Yet through physician-assisted suicide, we are cutting off that powerful witness and conversion that can take place in our own death and in the lives that continue to go on of others.
I think that the other deaths that I've seen since, I have been sensitive to wanting to see the beauty in the life as it is receding, not so much as a pain, but as a gift.
We're going to come back on that because I'm actually going to share the story about my own grandmother and uncles and other family members who I've seen the beauty at the end of their lives that are so important to talk about.
It is.
Timmery will be right back. Send her a tweet at Timmery. That's T-I-M-M-E-R-I-E. You're listening to Trending with Timmery, where morality and culture meet, offering an eternal perspective on today's hottest topics.
Coming up this summer, I am excited to share. I'll be speaking at the Youth Conference for Singles for Christ in San Diego. So be sure to go check out my Facebook page. You can find me at Trending with Timmery for more information for that. And I've got some exciting videos coming up a little later in the summer. I've done a little bit of work with Jubilee Media as well with EWTN this summer. So keep an eye out. I wanted to share in this final segment, we've been talking a lot about physician-assisted suicide, arguments from autonomy, how it's a slippery slope here in the United States, that if we continue to see physician-assisted suicide become the norm at the end of life, whether it's the end of a child's life that's terminally ill, or our own grandparents, that we are at the point where justifications will be made to give a lethal dose of medication to end that person's life. And we talked earlier in the show a little bit with Richard about how it used to be, you know, people would see death as a part of growing up and living life. Often every 20 years there would be a death, whether it was in the family or of a close friend, and often that death took place within the home. This is an experience that I have had. I will actually refer to it as the opportunity to witness, and it ties in both the reality and the importance of family as well as a Catholic worldview surrounding the importance of suffering, both as a witness that someone lives out and also as impacting other people. So my own great-grandmother, I remember during the last 3 years of her life dying of essentially old age, she really gave me the opportunity to be close to her in her final months. Remember those last few months? I was in the middle of preparing for Nutcracker performance in December. I can't remember. I know I was dancing the role of Spanish waltz of the flowers, snow, and I had a lot of, you know, rehearsals every weekend, hours, usually all day. Saturday and Friday night was dedicated to dance rehearsals. But at the same time, my grandmother was dying, and I recognized that this is where she was at in life, and there was an opportunity as I had time. I was also homeschooled, so it allowed for some flexibility in terms of location for where I stayed, to live with my grandmother, and whether it was assisting with helping with foods for her to eat or sitting and visiting. I remember fixing her hair, you know, the little hair she had left with the cute little curls at the end, or one day deciding I wanted to paint her toenails or whatever it might have been. I had that really special time to both see her and hearing her stories, but also to see the deterioration that took place in her memory, in her conversations. I remember, you know, earlier on in the process, I had a class I was taking nearby and my grandpa dropped me off at the house and left. And I showed up at the door and was knocking and she wouldn't let me into the house because she didn't remember who I was. And so I sat outside the screen door as it was locked, just talking to her. She just thought that I was that strange girl. And after maybe an hour of sitting outside, I finally convinced her to let me come inside and sit with her, even though she didn't remember that I was her granddaughter. And those are one of those painful memories and moments that we experience when our loved ones are continuing to lose faculties, awareness, memories. But it was a great impact on me to see that even in the midst of losing the ability to go to the bathroom by yourself, being dependent on someone who maybe feels uncomfortable trying to help you use the restroom, for anyone who's maybe gone through those sad and also awkward moments. You know, I remember her needing to use the restroom and she wasn't at the point where she wasn't unable to use the restroom, but she needed help getting to the restroom. And being about 12, 13 years old, I remember just, okay, get her to where she's able to hold on to the counter close enough to the wall where she can, you know, get her clothes on and off by herself and I'm out of here running. You know, this is an experience that many people have with their adult parents as they continue to age. And it's a reality of life. Yet that dependence of friends, family members, parents really challenges those around them to get uncomfortable. Okay, my father doesn't remember who I am. Maybe a spouse is losing their ability to carry a conversation about decisions that need to be made toward the end of life. Yet that person still intrinsically has value. Despite, again, the loss of faculties, a terminal illness, despite they may be at the end of a life that has lasted 90 years or 10 years and they're facing a tumor, as Rick Howick just spoke of, his young friend that died in her 20s. This is a real part of life. And as Catholics, we have to remember, we do not know the time or place that we ourselves will die, just like we don't know the time or place that Jesus will come again. But death is imminent. And, you know, we talk about so many of the sexual moral issues and current ideologies here on Trending with Timory, yet we don't talk enough about death. The reason we talk about abortion and contraception and marriage is because these issues determine how we will live the rest of our lives. And we're living in a time where we want that absolute autonomy and want to be disconnected from anything else in our lives, not to be tied down, not to be burdened, to the point where we justify abortion and we justify physician-assisted suicide. And in some parts of the world, euthanasia, right? Where a doctor or a family member could decide, oh, this life isn't worth living. It's a burden. Therefore, I can end it without the consent of the individual who maybe has a terminal illness. Or in the case in the Netherlands, we've seen cases where people are choosing to commit physician-assisted suicide for reasons of depression, anxiety. There are some cases around the world where we've seen someone who's identified as transgender and struggling. Is this where we want to go? And unless you and I have these difficult conversations, we're not going to know what to do in the situations. I remember my grandmother, you know, toward the end of her life, she was in pain. Yet she lived through it. We saw the facial expressions, her appetite as it continued to decrease. I remember, you know, being young and in 13, oh my gosh, like, are we starving her because she's not able to eat? You can't force a person to eat. But again, their body begins to shut down. And at the very end, she was in pain. And so she did receive a dosage of morphine that helped to alleviate pain, but it wasn't a high enough dosage that would kill her. And that was a really big distinction that I remember. Even at the time, the physician-assisted suicide debate was very real here in the state of California. And I saw it as the morphine did impact her breathing, but it didn't kill her. And I think that this is where we talk about intention with physician-assisted suicide. People say, well, I don't want my loved one to suffer. We don't want to see them change. I remember there's a picture we have of my grandmother where, I don't know the medical terminology, but essentially it looked almost like she had varicose veins in her face where there was a lot of redness in the skin. And so my grandma was my grandmother, right? But her face, her skin did not look the same. Yet even though our bodies may change and deteriorate, we might find ourselves in a coma at some point and not able to awake again. Who we are does not change. And there's a value no matter what that state in life is. And for me, it was such a testament to see her suffer, but also to see her live her life. And I have to tell you, it was really neat. In the final days, it was recognized, especially over the last 48 hours, that she had so many friends and family members constantly coming in and out of her house because we cared for her in the home, that she wasn't dying because she was so happy that another grandchild, a great grandchild, a cousin, a son would be in there. We surrounded her bedside with laughter and joy and stories, and she was able to be escorted into the next part of her life, which we have to remember. Do we face life thinking about life after death? She was escorted into that and ushered into the new reality, right? And faced before her heaven, hell, and purgatory. And I truly believe, I'm sure that my grandmother, with so many prayers and just so much of the good that she's done in so many of our lives, that she would have at least gone to purgatory based on the way she lived her life. And at the end, I was coming to this, we actually had to decrease the number of people that could be in the room because she would become so excited. Her heart rate would be elevated as so many people were around. You know, she would be wakeful, and toward the end, she was less and less wakeful, that we ended up having to limit to one visitor in the room at a time because she was just so stimulated by the presence of all of us there. She wasn't willing to let go just yet. And so our family all had the opportunity to be present as my grandmother died, whether it was directly in the room or in the room next door. But that testament of her life, all the way to the last dying breath, really is a reminder that life is about living, and it's not about taking our lives on our own terms. And it's something for you to think about. Why is it that through abortion, physician-assisted suicide, we are justifying the killing of our own family members? And we're missing that salvific value and the opportunity for conversion and sacrificial love and caring for each other and being present to each other day in and day out. I hope that this episode has really challenged you to have a different idea about death, and just a recommendation for reading. I mention it often, St. Alphonsus Liguori's incredible book, Preparation for Death.
This has been Trending with Timory. To book her to speak or learn more about her guests, visit radiotrending.com. That's radiotrending.com. You can listen to more of Trending via the podcast on iTunes, Google Play, or the iHeartRadio app, where you can share your favorite episodes.